Kia ora, welcome to episode 22 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Aisha Green at Yana Miller's Gallery in Te Whanganui, Atara, before she embarked on a move to the United Kingdom. Aisha is Ngā Te Kahanunu Kai Tahu. Among several qualifications, she has a graduate diploma specialising in museums and cultural heritage, and a Master of Fine Arts from the Elam School of Fine Arts, both from the University of Auckland. Her work is held in numerous public and private collections, including Te Papa Tongarewa, the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tāmaki, the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna o Waiwhitu, the Douse Art Museum, the MTG and the Hawke's Bay Tai Ahuriri, and the Dunedin Public Art Gallery. She has exhibited at a number of public art galleries, including the Tauranga Art Gallery, Auckland Art Gallery, City Gallery in Wellington, Te Uru in Te Tirangi, and has a long list of awards and residencies to her name. Aisha is represented by Yana Miller's Gallery in Wellington. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil Aisha Green Instagram post for your reference. You'll hear Aisha speak about the sense of responsibility she has to whānau, hapū and iwi in her practice, her want to interrogate and poke fun at propaganda, her relationship with Joseph Banks and the English royal family, the backhanded compliment that the current coalition government is paying to Māori, and the role of botanicals and textiles in her paintings. We started by talking about Aisha's childhood.
As a child, I didn't really have the concept that I was Māori. I didn't really understand what that was or what that meant. Obviously, my nana is Māori and my mum. So my Māori whakapapa is through the matriarchal line for like four generations. But, you know, we would go back to one of our marae. As you said, I'm Ngāi Tahu, but I'm also Ngā Te Kahanunu. Mm. And so the marae that we'd always go back to was in Central Hawke's Bay, Rā Kau Tātahi, and that was usually for tangi. That was the sort of only times I really sort of thought about being Māori, but then I didn't even think about it at all because it was just such a... It just felt very ordinary, I guess.
Ordinary just because it was in the day-to-day. There was, you know, wood for the trees in terms of a positive experience of being Māori.
Yeah, I guess. I just hadn't really thought that there was something significant or special about going to tangi and
day
being
to
Māori. Yeah. So it felt, I guess, mundane. It was sort of like just mundane. So I never really thought about like what that meant as a child. So I didn't really come to understand what it might mean to be Māori until a lot later, until I was sort of in my early 20s, actually.
So there's been quite a lot of success, it's fair to say, in the last few years. Winning the Rydell Prize in 2020, you have works in Te Papa, Dunedin Public Art Gallery, Christchurch Art Gallery, got the Art Gallery of Auckland, Toi o Tāmaki. In the context of all that, how crushing was it when you didn't pass sixth form art?
It was annoying.
Was it? You cared?
Well, no, I wasn't surprised, let's just say that.
Why weren't you surprised?
The work was rubbish. It was absolute trash. I think I made it the night before and just stuck it to my board. Because I wanted to work in film, I wanted to be like a cinematographer, so I had more focus on photography. And we were really lucky because we had a dark room, and the head of art there used the dark room, so he really kept it up to scratch. And I went to a really low decile school. So yeah, photography was where I was at and what I was interested in. And I got, you know, merit. I was NCEA, the second year of NCEA, and I got a merit for my photography. Thank you very much.
Okay.
But yes, painting was terrible. Our teacher was not a great teacher. She was very cruel. But looking back as an adult, I really felt for our teacher because we were horrendous students, actually. So her kind of constant frustration and anger, and I think she cried on multiple times. Like, that's just the high school I went to where teachers are crying because of the behaviour of the students. I think about her sometimes and feel for her.
I wonder what drive there was after failing sixth form art but credits in photography. That was the drive to kind of keep investigating a career in the arts.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I had never thought that I was going to be an artist, let alone a painter. You know, the art that I kind of knew about was paintings and photography, and I didn't even really understand sculpture. Like, this is all leaving high school. And I didn't do seventh form. Instead, I started at WinTech to do, it's like a Bachelor of Media Arts, and I was going to major in moving image. But in the first year, you don't major. You have a whole bunch of kind of like art practice papers. And that's when I learned about what art could be, that there was like video art and like crazy sculpture, installation, like light art. To me, that just like blew my mind. And I was like, this is crazy. And that was really exciting. And I still went on to major in moving image. But what had happened is that it took me 5 years to do my 3-year degree because I guess I was young, so I kept dropping out of papers, sort of just mucked around. There was a few semesters I had off. And in my last year, I'd done all my moving image stuff. And in this last 2 years, I had to do all the catch-up papers, like contextual papers and mucking around papers, really, that give a broader art sense. And that's when I started really investing in, like, different kind of, like, art research. So I remember looking into, like, Ronnie Van Hout and, like, Vito Acconci and being like, wow, what is this kind of work? And that was where I started thinking about having an art practice rather than a film career.
And thinking about painting?
No. that came still later, yeah. I wanted to make video installation. So basically what happened was I finished up at WinTech. I had a year out. I was like, I want to be an artist. How do I do that? And then I'd come to visit a friend in Wellington, actually, and went to City Gallery. And there was this exhibition on. And I don't know why, but in all the artist labels, it said where everyone had graduated from. Huh. I don't think they really do that now. But, you know, 80% of the artists in the exhibition had graduated from Elam. So I was like, okay, so if I want to be an artist, I should try and go to Elam. And so I applied and was denied.
What?
Yeah, I applied for a postgraduate diploma that would then take me into masters, but my marks from WinTech were terrible, and they were right to acknowledge that I didn't really have an art practice because I didn't. So instead I did what they called a transcert, which was a year studying alongside fourth year students who weren't doing honours. Yeah, so it was kind of a year getting ready to go into postgraduate study, and I'm so pleased that they realised that because I had a terrible first semester at Elam.
You needed to slow down to consider where a practice might go.
Well, I didn't even really know how to have a studio practice. Like, I didn't know how to make art. I had a lot of ideas, but I didn't know how to, like, get them to be made. And it's not that I mean how to use the tools, like, but it was more like, here's an idea, and then it's like, okay, we'll go make it. And I'm like, oh, but what? So I really struggled, and it was in the mid-semester, well, the mid-year break, I had a boyfriend at the time, and he had moved to Auckland with me, and he was a painter, and so he didn't have a job, and he'd just sit around all day at home painting, and I was kind of jealous, because here I was making these, like, video works and, like, lugging gear around and having to edit, and it just sucked, and here he was just, like, self-contained art making. So I had to go, like, in the break, I was like, I'm going to paint too, and then I was like, that was kind of fun. And he was like, oh, you're okay at it. I was like, oh, okay. And so then that was it, basically.
And this is before you did your MFA at Elam.
Yeah, so it was in 2011.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then into the MFA.
And well, then, yeah, postgraduate diploma and then an MFA. So 2 years.
Maybe we're retrofitting here. It looks like an imbalance of the mix of degrees. So, you know, WinTech 2009, MFA 2013,
yes.
And then the Graduate Diploma in Museums and Cultural Heritage.
That's right, yes.
It looks like at that point you were beginning to get a really strong sense of the education that you wanted to be able to apply to the practice you'd envisaged for yourself.
Exactly. It was like I'd come out of my MFA and I felt that I understood visual language, like I'd learnt the language per se. But then I was like, well, what do I even want to say in this language? And I had still these kinds of questions about the world that I thought, you know, I could kind of research myself, but actually I need some assistance to even know where to begin. And so that's why I went back to uni and did the Museums and Cultural Heritage, because I had questions about sort of Māori agency, colonisation, nationalism. And so all the papers I kind of took in that year were all sort of grounded in these kinds of ideas to extend a research practice. And so, yeah, a lot of my foundational ideas to my practice come from that year at doing Museums of Cultural Heritage.
Becoming reacquainted with Otako Marae has been an education as well, quite an important one.
Having a relationship with Otako Runaka there and with all of my kind of extended whānau, what that's kind of done is actually showed me the type of responsibility I have to them and to, like, us as a hapū, but also to the wider iwi. So it's not like going in and kind of taking knowledge and then going back to my studio and, like, tutuing around. It's more understanding that my practice has things that outreach myself as an individual. And actually, even though, yes, it's, like, my paintings and, like, my ideas, there's something, it's about sort of something beyond myself. And so, like, seeing and connecting in with all of my whānau there, I can see how and what is needed or how I want that relationship to be and what I can bring to it, really.
So that piece of research, especially in the context of the museums and cultural heritage diploma, like, increasingly I look at your practice and think, yeah, you're a painter, but it feels like increasingly you're a researcher and a historian as much as anything else.
Well, I guess I go into making work not... For me, the studio is not a playful place. Like, I'm not in there playing around. Usually what I'm going to make is already kind of mapped out in terms of why make that painting, what is it going to do, where does it sit in terms of a larger, like, visual history, because as you know, a lot of my works is using history painting. And so, yeah, I'm trying to respond to already produced knowledge, I guess. If history paintings produce knowledge, I'm responding to that knowledge. And so, yeah, I guess there is research that goes into that. It's sort of, I'm not playing around, which sounds so boring and sad.
Well, not at all. I mean, it just seems like, ironically, the painting part of your practice is actually a very, very small, like, part of what you do. Like I've heard you talk about the painting process being just colouring in, which seems to probably sell yourself a little bit short. But thinking about that, it's like, well, yeah, you mean it literally, but I take it you mean it figuratively as well. Like, you're adding colour to all of that research.
Well, it's about contributing to that, to the research that's already out there. It's like at university, if you're a lecturer, you might write an academic paper and have it published in a journal, whereas an artist, the academic paper I'm writing is actually an artwork that I'm making, and I'm going to publish it in a gallery. So it's just like a different way of talking about things that are talked about or written about in written, you know, language, whereas I'm using, like, a visual language to do the same.
Well, look, for, you know, fear of stating the obvious here, like, one of the things that I find increasingly fascinating about paintings is the power of them as a single still image. More than anyone, you seem really acutely aware of the power of images, so not just your own, but the ones that you're, you know, working from or referencing. Where does that awareness of the power of images come from, or when did you start thinking about the power of images?
My research into the power of the image came at the sort of the beginning of some questions that I was asking, and those questions are what led me back to do the museums and cultural heritage papers. But I remember I was catching a bus across the country, I think from Auckland to Wellington. It's a 10-hour bus ride. It's horrific. It takes a part of your soul. And we stopped in Rotorua, and there was a kapahaka performance at the information centre. And there was a loudspeaker that said, "To see the Maori performance, be here in 5 minutes." I was like, "What is this?" And, you know, here was this sort of kapahaka and waiata and these tourists taking videos, and everyone was like, "Wow, it's amazing." And I remember going, like, is this a Māori performance? Like, what is Māori performance? Who is this performance for? And what is it saying about being Māori? Because I can't do waiata, I don't do kapahaka, I can't speak Te Reo, I'm also, like, white. And so all of these things that signify what it is to be Māori, I don't fall into these categories, yet I still am. So that was quite, like, the beginning question. And I think now I can look back and feel like that's sort of a juvenile question, which it was, but that's led me on to understanding how representation has power and how representation can create knowledge. But that knowledge... there's also power in knowledge, obviously, because it depends who's creating knowledge and giving out the knowledge, which I think is why I get so interested in Joseph Banks and the way that he sort of named all these plants. I think that's a really good example to look at how knowledge can be one-sided or colonial and is used as power. Bringing that around back to your question is that I'm interested in kind of New Zealand propaganda or British colony propaganda and how that affects how we understand ourselves or how I understand myself as a Māori or the rights of Māori and Māori agency. And what I want to do is unpack that propaganda and sort of really poke holes in it or poke fun at it or realign it so that we can see how silly the propaganda is, I think.
As we've mentioned, the practice is so often about the recreation of images. Are they parody? Is it reclamation? Is it resetting? Is it mimicry? Is it all of the above?
It's definitely, well, mimicry and like copying is a sort of method that I use. And that method to copy something is to really say that there's no authentic thing. So I'll try and kind of break it down. Like in essentialist terms is that things have essences that make them what they are.
Mm.
And I guess I'm trying to be like anti-essentialist and that actually culture and identity is constantly shifting and changing. There is no sort of essentialism. But also the idea is that something has so much power, there's this original, right? But if we can copy it, we actually take away the power of the original and we take away the power of the essential or the essentialist ideas. So in a lot of my work, the copying is about taking that power away and kind of reclaiming it. But I don't think the works aren't really, I wouldn't say they're like satire or parody. They're probably more about like joy or kind of love, which is sort of how I approach it. I think I can feel quite angry or annoyed about the world or the history of New Zealand and these kinds of things. But actually, I find that that kind of anger isn't helpful to make change. It's just kind of an emotion that can become overwhelming. And so there's more of a sort of a love approach, which sounds so cheesy, but yeah.
Well, but you must... You also send, well, you send this viewer, at least, back to the original source material. There's plenty of paintings that I had no idea existed. I see an Aisha Green painting, and I think, oh, that is, you know, that is a recreation of a work. I go back and look at the original work, which has me then considering where it comes from, why, how your work is responding to it. It ends up being this really interesting game of spot the difference, almost. I don't know if you know those kids' pictures where you have to kind of go through the images, and your practice feels a little bit like that as well, which for me is a sense of joy. You know, there's a whole lot of fun in that.
The different, yeah, because when I copy, obviously it's more illustrative and cartoonish than like a lot of the history painting that I'm copying.
Yeah.
But I think what maybe gets forgotten is that art is extremely powerful in sending messages and creating ideology, which then can become kind of hegemonic ideas. So, you know, how do we think New Zealand was colonized? Well, they put up posters and advertisements advertising for people to come over. Mm. How did they convince people to come over? Because someone drew a beautiful landscape.
Mm.
And so it's because of art and it's because of print and all of these things that colonization happened. It was aided by visual language or visual objects, visual material. So how do we now, today, in today's time, how do we use art to kind of retell that story or to turn it around and change the narrative in a way?
Well, that reminds me makes me think of a quote from the gallerist Tim Melville. He succinctly described your work really well, I think, as an iron fist in a velvet glove. Now, I'm assuming you're really cognizant of the contrast of, you know, how you render those images, the, you know, graphic or cartoon, you know, nature that you paint in, and how that style offers really easy access for a viewer into quite challenging ideas. Is that something you're quite cognizant of?
Yes, definitely. I think I just want, there's so many different types of audiences. I think people always go, the audience, but there's so many different types of audiences because there's so many different types of people.
Mm.
And so, I mean, firstly, children, like, great, they can see a big colourful painting, that's cool, happy for that. But also for, like, Māori and for the iwi, sometimes there's things going on in the paintings that they might only understand because it's historic and significant for them, and so that's fine, and other people might not see those things. But there's also another audience, which I think maybe people don't talk about enough, which is the collecting audience and the people who have access to collect artworks and how those people have accumulated wealth to become collectors.
Mm-hmm.
Could be at the detriment to Māori. And so as well, it's going, I'm not trying to like be an educator and like, I mean, I don't mind. I think a lot of artists are like, I'm not here to educate you, or a lot of activists are like, do your own research. But I kind of don't mind being like, no, it's fine, let's talk about it, because I want to talk about it inwardly so people can maybe consider their position, whether that be inherited wealth or their position now as a person in their own job, making sure that Māori have agency in their own workplaces. So I think there's so many different audiences, and I don't, like I said, I don't want to approach it with anger or like telling people off, but it's more like, let's care together about these issues. I want people to care with me.
So as much as they're an iron fist and a velvet glove, they're a Trojan horse as well in private collections, in people's houses. You probably a stupid thing to say, but you want them to spark conversations in people's homes as much as you do in, say, a gallery space.
I mean, what I like about having exhibitions at public galleries is being able to talk to people about the work. And so sometimes it's more that the work becomes an excuse to talk about issues rather than talk about the work itself. And so the work is used as a way to talk across diverse peoples about certain issues that are dear to my heart, like Māori power. So it's not necessarily Trojan horse, because sometimes the good things that happen are just in being able to take people through the gallery and talk to them about the works one-on-one or do an artist talk. And what's been really nice about living in Wellington is that I was living here when the show at City Gallery was up, so I was able to take through lots of different groups of people.
This is folk nationalism, just for listener reference.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And so that's been a really valuable experience, being able to take people through and talk about the work. Because when you talk about the work, you start to talk about New Zealand history, you know, so you start to kind of unpack all of these things. Yeah, when I'm talking about my work, I'm not usually talking about the brush stroke or the colour or the line.
Well, that's what I mean. You're a researcher and historian seems first and a painter second.
Yes, yeah, totally, yeah.
Speaking of, like, you know, people in that gallery space, so City Gallery, I was in there looking at that show a few months ago and had a staff member approach me, because I think I was standing looking at a work for quite a while, and they were asking, you know, what I thought of it. And she told me that one of the favourite things she'd heard an audience member say was a guy who seemed frustrated, who'd said, I don't know if she's not a very good painter or if she's a really good painter. And that's a subversion that seems to work really well for you, right? Like, in terms of being able to invite people in really easily with a straightforward proposition, again, to present some tricky ideas or some challenging ideas.
I mean, I've actually heard that before. I overheard that once when someone was talking about my work and they said, we heard it was so bad that it's good. And it broke my little heart. This was quite a long time ago. I was like, wow, that's so cruel.
But now do you see that from a different angle? People look at it and think, well, hang on a minute, is this even painting? Is my kid could do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm like, well, whatever. Yeah, those sorts of, that doesn't like hurt me or anything. But good, question what art is, because actually art is also, it's everywhere. I mean, if we start talking about like design or graphic design and like posters, and we see images around us all the time. So yeah, maybe it is good to take those things into the gallery. I guess we could probably, leading on from that, it's talking about like high art and low art, and that like there's so many different types of ways of making art. And I think that's what's so exciting about seeing so many young Māori artists coming up and all of their different types of work, all of the kind of weaving, using earth pigments. These would always normally be classified as like customary practice and never kind of extended as contemporary art. And so even though I'm not sort of using those customary, I'm doing the bunny ears, practice, I am still dealing with this idea of low art, the quotation marks.
Yeah.
And so maybe, good, if people are coming into the gallery and they're like, is it painting? Is it good? Is it bad? Then maybe that kind of questioning can extend beyond to really think about what is art and what should be in galleries.
Yeah, because I've wondered if you deliberately simplify the image to give the viewer, you know, more time to consider what they're looking at. I.e., you know, visually it's really easy to take your work in really quickly. So is there a balance there of giving them more time then to think, hang on, what am I looking at?
Well, I think for me, it's never about one work per se. It's about how all the works feed off each other and not necessarily tell a story, but start to like form a bigger picture. So I usually don't work in like singular image making. Every work I make is usually made in response to other work. So there'll be like a foundational work that I've thought of. And in folk nationalism, it was The Rupture. that was a beginning work, and that's kind of interesting to me, actually, because that's not a copy. That's actually of my own imagination.
And as a quick aside here for listeners, there will be an image of the rupture on the Gord Oil Instagram page for your reference.
But so that was the foundational work, and then everything kind of grew in response to that, or response to kind of an idea. So, yeah, I'm more interested in making exhibitions rather than making artworks, if that makes sense. Mm. So
you want to create a narrative rather than single works.
Well, it's more that not all of the ideas can be held in one work, and so they're kind of extended through a bunch of works, and they can come together to create new ideas and or sort of interrogate what I've been looking at together as a team. It's like teamwork.
Well, that probably brings me to a quote of yours. I'm always making sure that I'm responsible and accountable and answerable to my own work. Have you become accountable to work in ways you hadn't anticipated?
No, would be like the kind of short answer. But there has been things that have happened that were sad, that made me realise how much trouble there is in New Zealand that other people might not understand, is that when I was making the sculpture in Dunedin, Ko Te Tūhono, I worked closely with the Runaka, which is Otago, which is also where I whakapapa. And there was three women from the Runaka who were like Runaka leaders and myself, and I worked closely with them just on little things like, is this going well and how do we manage this? And one of the last meetings we had before the sculpture was kind of unveiled was that we had to come up with a plan to counteract the racism, which I hadn't actually thought about. And so,
And for listener reference, this sculpture is now in the Octagon in Dunedin.
That's right.
And is a recreation of like part of the marae.
Yes, so the doorway into the marae, yeah, which is in itself a copy of a carving. Yeah, it's complicated. You can Google it. But I hadn't thought about the racism that was going to come out of that. And so there was actually a strategic way to make sure that the public was on board with the artwork. And so it was little things like getting the newspaper to write positive stories about Māori history or local Māori history in the lead up to the unveiling of the sculpture. Whether that we, you know, they put that into practice and that actually happened, I'm not too sure. But we did have to have a big conversation about how we're going to deal with the fallout and how we're going to support the kids who are going to have to deal with that. And I was like, oh my gosh, like here I am sitting in this meeting talking about how we're going to combat racism from an artwork that's going to go up. And it was heartbreaking.
So that must have made you reconsider what it means to be accountable for work, even future work.
I think it's more like people think accountability as like I can answer to the work and I can hold and be responsible, and if it's a bad work or I've done something wrong, I can apologise and hold that, right? Mm. But also accountability means like making change or trying to say big things in the world can be scary because of how other people react, which then hurts people. So it's not that the work hurt the young Māori in our community. The work hurt old Pākehā men generally, who are then going to hurt young Māori, yeah. You know? That's how I learnt that accountability, it doesn't just mean the artwork, it means the fallout from the artwork.
Does that mean that there has been, or is there work that you've shelved or is on hold, like ideas that you have because you don't feel like you can be accountable to them yet? Or that the New Zealand public is not ready for that work yet?
No, there's no works that I haven't made because of those reasons. Like, there's definitely works I haven't made because they're bad.
Have you made work and thought, bugger it, I'm going to make the work? Why would I shy away from this?
Well, actually, yes. The work, the rupture that we were just speaking about, I was nervous about showing that work because it's like two women representing Rangi and Papa. Mm. And, you know, they're always represented as a man and a woman. And I also know that, like, putting faces on Atua or like representing gods as human figures is kind of a no-no too, which I've only just recently sort of learnt. And I think that painting was made by then, but it hadn't been shown. But I made the decision not to pull it because I was kind of happy to kind of question those ideas about Atua and gender and also homosexual relations, I guess.
Well, that might be a good point to jump into, again, accountability, because I think about, well, I think you're probably no more accountable to yourself than in your self-portraits. So self-portraits, you know, feature in the practice quite a bit. Is that the, you know, ultimate responsibility for you, like when you're painting yourself?
Actually, it's kind of the opposite.
Is it?
Yes, because it means that whenever I paint myself, it's more of just a stand-in. I'm just a stand-in for something. So it's not, I mean, what it firstly is it's not my mum or my nana or my brothers or my dad who I paint. And then it's not just a random person or it's not a friend. So all of a sudden I take away all of those kinds of contexts to read the painting in, like, oh, it's a painting of Yisha's nana. And then it becomes about matriarch or like grandparents or whānau or something. Whereas if I put myself in it, it just becomes about being a Māori woman. I feel that I just use my own body as a stand-in because having other people's bodies adds different types of context to the work.
That's interesting because a favourite dynamic for me, like as a viewer, of your practice is that you strike this really nice balance of inviting us in by sharing a really personal experience, but then that does set this scene of a much bigger narrative. So I had a conversation with you, I think about a year ago at McCann House, where I was asking about you seemingly toggling between family and the really personal, but then this much bigger picture of painting the English royal family, you know, through multiple generations of them. But you don't see the separation between your family and the royal family. Like, yeah. you see more of a, you know, the more being connected than separate.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. We are connected. The royal family, I mean, by their, what they do, like settler colonisation and colonisation and the expansion of the empire, by that alone has affected my whole family and my whole whakapapa. Mm. And so the actions that they have taken have affected me. They're not... So therefore, to me, they're not strangers or things far away. But also it's about breaking down those hierarchies, like who, just because they were born, why are they in power? I mean, I know really they're kind of not in power now. Are they? I don't know. Do we need the monarchy? I'm not sure.
Yeah, these are great questions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of obsessed, but not because I'm into it, but because it's just very fascinating, these things that, you know, like what? It's 2023. It's crazy. So yeah, I feel connected to them, even though I've never met them or don't know them personally and they don't know I exist, you know?
Well, that's a good question again about power structures, because I think about a recent change in government in New Zealand. I fear, if anything, that's giving you, if not like us, lots of potential new subject material, especially where Māori fit into New Zealand. Or for you, are you playing a longer game and you more wanting to address, you know, the crown rather than whoever is currently in government representing the crown?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this myself, actually, and, like, what is the role of artists in this time? And have kind of come to realise that I'm not, like, a reactionary artist. All of the work that I've ever made, or my whole practice, has already commented on what's going on now. Mm. It's, like, preempted it in a way. Mm. So I think what's crazy about this new coalition government is that they're doing, like, colonization 101. Like, they're so uneducated that they're doing everything that was already done. But what it is also, I've kind of realized, is this backhanded compliment to Māori, because Māori have done so well that the government has had to come in and go back to all of these colonial techniques. I mean, Māori have always been included in the nation symbolically. And what I mean by that is that Māori were, firstly, didn't die out, and secondly, didn't assimilate completely. And so because Māori didn't completely assimilate, the nation or white New Zealand has had to hold on to some of those Māori things, like, but it's always symbolically, it's always like decorative. And, you know, like language, people would say kia ora, but it would be not much more than that. But that gave us our difference to England. So Māori were always used symbolically as a point of difference and a point of uniqueness. But now that we've had like 100 years of our ancestors and our tūpuna working really hard to keep the language going, to keep tikanga upheld, we've gone beyond the symbolic and the performative. It's actually having meaning and making and changing lives. Even, you know, the Māori Health Authority, it takes a long time for Māori to go through university to become doctors. It takes a long time to go through university to become medical researchers. And so what we're seeing is that we know that Māori have unequal health outcomes because Māori have gone in and done that research and figured it out. And that takes generational time. And so Māori are on the right track, and this is a great way of knowing that we're on the right track. Of course, it's like heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, it's like horrific, but good to know that what we've been doing is working.
So you do seem to take a really long view. I mean, that's an incredibly encouraging long view to take of where we're at as a nation, especially for Māoridom.
I think so. I mean, I feel, yeah, I still have to kind of think about it a lot, about what is my role and what do I want my artwork to do. But sometimes, and what I've been thinking lately, is about not making certain works, and not because they're bad works or they're not appropriate, but because who's going to view that work and what are they going to do with it? And why should they have anything to do with my work, which is about being Māori, when they don't care?
Are we back to talking about collectors and why they might own certain work?
I think to take it kind of beyond just like talking about collectors is more talking about how much of myself do I want in the world right now when I feel like the government doesn't want it. Do you know what I mean? So like, why should I give that to the world? Who voted these people in? And so if they don't want Te Reo, if they don't want a Māori Health Authority, then they can't have my art. And so right now, I don't want to be painting anything about myself or like about being Māori. I mean, all of my work is going to be about that. But there's ways to kind of subvert it. Respect me and then I'll respect you.
So is there work that you're... Sounds like there is work you're holding back or reshaping maybe to as a reaction to that.
Yeah, I guess you're right, and it's come from a place of anger. So I've just gone against everything I've said to you.
Well, no, I mean, they coexist, right? Like, the sense of wanting to deliver some colour and some joy into the world can be a response to being angry about something.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's like I can't... At this point in time, I'm not, as I said, I'm not really reactionary. I just need some time to, like, process it. Mm. But I think as well that's, like, a major privilege, like, that I am able to just sit down and process it, where I've got, like, whānau that are having to, like, deal with this immediately right now. Yeah, I want to acknowledge that. I understand I'm very lucky to be able to take that time out and to reflect. But, yeah, I guess I do feel a bit bitter.
In terms of taking time, I guess associated with that, and especially around sense of whakapapa not being linear in time, and actually, by the way, listener aside here, I need to give some credit to a piece that I read while researching for this interview by Hannah Burgess in the Pantograph Punch, a piece about basically whakapapa, as I say, not being linear time, and you managed to bend time or almost time travel in a way that I think Stephen Hawking would even be proud of. Do you see that non-linear time, especially in the context of whakapapa, as a really useful idea to play with in the practice? So for example, I think about Joseph Banks, who I've mentioned, you know, once already. You guys are having an increasingly close relationship, it feels like, and especially works where, you know, you've painted yourself most recently as Joseph Banks, but also Joseph Banks is writing you postcards as well, or before you existed.
It's funny with Joseph Banks because there is a running joke that, like, I'm in love with him.
Well, there is a weird close relationship, right?
But I think he's just such an easy subject because how I feel about Joseph Banks is that, yes, he, like, lives in this past, right? And, of course, he is dead now. But his legacy, if you want to call it, I guess legacy is the right word, but what he has done still affects my life day to day, and it has affected my family's life, the way that he's created knowledge, how his knowledge creates Eurocentric systems that we live in. I know he's just kind of like a botanist, right? But how we even understand ecology and plant life is because of how he put all that in place. And so Māori ways of understanding the ecology have just been like chucked out because of what this man has done, which affects my day-to-day life. So yes, I feel like sometimes it might feel that I'm sort of digging around in the past and like things, you know, it's old news or something, but actually it's not. It's news that affects us today.
You've mentioned Joseph Banks, you know, Banks, and as a botanist, and botanicals, you know, so often feature in work. So yeah, I'm really curious about where they fit in. They're more than just a vehicle for place and sovereignty. Like, they're something that you seem to really want to celebrate as well.
Yeah, I first started painting botanicals when I copied Joseph Banks's Florigerum. I can never say that word. That book of all the botanicals that he made, which actually wasn't published in his lifetime. But that was more about reclaiming the power or knowledge of those plants. And I think that's probably kind of carried through in my work. But then there's become this way of sort of making pattern as well, having looked at wallpaper or fabric patterns, because they, I don't think the word is tessellate. I think I've always used that word wrongly, but they repeat at certain points. Mm. And so there's this idea that it's kind of never ending. So using this kind of pattern is a way to create a space that doesn't end at the edge of the canvas, with the idea that it could just be continuous.
Oh, so that reflects non-linear time as well.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, or like it's just like a vast cosmic something. I don't know, I can't talk about or think about space too much because it freaks me out how infinite it is.
Well, it's funny you say that. You've made me immediately think of two Māori boys in an English field,
right,
and how cosmic that painting feels because,
right,
of that,
yes,
repetition of pattern,
yes,
of botanicals.
Yeah.
The intention with that work or not?
I wanted it to feel expansive and like a huge field.
Mm. But maybe not the size of the universe.
No, not the size of the universe. The universe is too big. I can't. My brain just explodes when I try and think of infinite.
I've also wondered with botanicals, like outside of reclamation and sovereignty, whether they are also a sign of connection to whenua for you.
Well, yes and no. I think when I first came into painting botanicals, like we spoke about, was through Joseph Banks and this idea of creating knowledge, which creates power.
Did Joseph Banks lead you to botanicals?
Yes. Ah. Yeah, he did. Yeah. And so there's always been that. But I think because I'm painting in this representational way that is not, you know, I'm painting a Western style. This is like Western style painting, which I, you know, I have to sort of also say that, of course, like cartoons and the flatness comes from a lot of other cultures. But for Māori, painting this kind of representational way wasn't a part of the way that they painted. It was very different. And so even just repainting how we paint those flowers is kind of interesting to me, because even the painting style is Western in its own way. And so it's kind of in a way trying to reclaim back even the idea of how and the style that we use to paint or draw botanicals. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think, for listener reference here, to look at a work of Aisha's that celebrates that, I Thought I Heard You Crying in the Forest. Great work to have a look at. And again, we'll include that in the Good Oil Instagram page for your reference. So that work really concentrates everything you've just said.
Exactly, yeah. And because that was copied, and the botanical book that was copied from, it had Latin, English, and Te Reo Māori, and that book was made in the 1970s-ish, I think 76. And so even then it was amazing to see that Te Reo Māori was coming through in understanding plant life, and that actually gave me a lot of hope that knowledge about things can change over time.
Oh, that slow change that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's a slow change, and that's kind of exciting. But also, when I think about botany, I also just think about classification systems of knowledge, which also just all kind of goes back into this essentialist idea. And I'm really kind of obsessed with the holotype. And do you know what a holotype is?
No.
A holotype is the thing that everything is measured against. So, yeah, this is also why I'm interested in botanicals. So Joseph Banks would have collected holotypes from New Zealand. So the holotype is the specimen that every other specimen is judged against to say whether it's a good example of the specimen.
That sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, so but it makes sense though, right? Because say you've got like a pine needle and you're like, is this a pine needle? You need another pine needle to assess it against.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's a thing that everything gets assessed against. So I love this idea that everything is based on that, because that actually just starts going into like linguistics or even like semantics. A dog, it has four legs, it has a tail, it has fur, and so you have to judge all dogs on this one dog. But what about a dog that has three legs? Is it still a dog? And so you have to start asking all these kinds of questions.
Surely this loops back to your own work. Like, there are holotypes being the original work that you're referencing.
Exactly, yes.
And then the work that you're creating off the back of it.
Yeah, totally.
So an idea you're clearly more and more obsessed with.
With holotypes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. There are a few holotypes in New Zealand, but I really want to see Joseph Banks or New Zealand plant holotypes, like, you know, like the classics. I'd love to see the holotypes of them, but I'm pretty sure that they'll be in England.
Mm.
Yeah. So yeah, that I think knowledge and power is about like classifications and putting things into order, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, listeners, we're sitting in Asia's dealer gallery, Yana Miller's in Wellington, with a little bit of street noise. It's all ambience as far as I'm concerned, the odd motorbike every now and again. The other thing that, so botanicals aside, the other thing that I feel like is so beautifully rendered in your work are textiles. And we've touched on textiles briefly already, but they so often feel like the quiet subject hero in your work. You know, so much of the work is block colour, but then you seem to take a real pleasure in this really beautiful rendering of textiles. And there's so many examples of this, like the lace on your Nana on her wedding day painting, Mum on her wedding day painting, the In the Beginning work, all of the Queen Elizabeth works. So even the lace tablecloths in the Still Life series. So is there a bit of a textiles obsession as well?
When I first did textiles was in the Queen Elizabeth series, and like that was sort of setting up a challenge for myself. I wanted to paint these queens, but a part of being Queen Elizabeth the First is all of the textiles and all of those patterns. So there's this idea of grandiose and power and wealth, and then that kind of flowed through into other works. And that the lace is also really important because that's kind of like, it feels very colonial Victorian, you know, this idea of lace. And so it's a challenge for my own painting self. It's a challenge in perseverance and patience.
So there's a love-hate relationship in painting textiles and botanicals, maybe? Because they seem like the thing, you know, when you come to your work and you lean into it, it's like, oh, wow, the beautiful detail outside of these big blocks of colour are these textiles and botanicals.
Yeah, they're really annoying to paint. Super annoying.
But it hurts. Love-hate relationship, you can't not paint them.
Yes, well, you kind of go, well, the painting needs it. It has to have it. And so I've just got to do it. And sometimes I bite off more than I can chew. And I'm like, why did I do that? I could have just not. And no one would have known the difference. But I would have.
When have you bitten off more than you can chew? What work are you talking about?
Constantly, all the time.
And by that, you mean you find yourself, you know, labouring over a work at 3 a.m. going, oh, why did I decide to paint all this lace?
Well, yes, that whole exhibition at Tuhu was that.
Yeah. So this is, again, for listener reference, this is the work Still Life. Is that what that whole show was
called? That's right, yeah.
So much lace tablecloth.
I don't know. I'm like, why did I decide to do that? I guess I had underestimated how long it would take. But, yeah, I try not to get thinking about that kind of thing. The work needed it. It made a lot of sense. But I think as well when, like you said, with a lot of my work, there is so much flat colour and kind of blocks of space that there needs to be these kinds of details that lead in to creating different types of compositions. But that does just come from kind of copying. But when I sort of copy images, I go, well, how much needs to stay in and how much can I take out? At what point does the image stop sort of telling the same story, and what needs to be in the image to kind of continue that on? So of course it's really important for Queen Elizabeth to have all of her lace patterns because that represents her power. And of course the lace should go on my Nana's wedding dress because that's about intercultural marriage and fulfilling these kinds of Christian worldviews and wedding dresses and things like that. So yes, there's always kind of a reason to do it. It doesn't mean I enjoy it.
Well, if there's any consolation, boy, they look great once they're in a work.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. You say thanks, like you can still feel the pain.
Well, yes, I mean, I get a really sore shoulder.
Literally the pain.
Yeah, it's literally painful.
Yeah. I forget what word you're most comfortable with, parodied, mimicked, recreated, but you've recreated Grant Wood's American Gothic. So again, a painting, a super famous painting, one that probably springs to mind for most listeners. If not a listener, a quick Google image search of American Gothic will reveal this. But you created that work in Nana and Grandad, and I think even subtitled it New Zealand Gothic. He said that he had to go to Paris to appreciate Ohio, where that painting is based. You've travelled a bit in the last 18 months and I think have some more travel planned. What is that travel that you've done, or even upcoming travel, what do you think it adds to the practice? Like, what new perspective has it given you, or what do you anticipate it will give you?
So yeah, I'm going to be going to the UK in about 4 or 5 months, and I'm really excited about going over there because I just want to be in the middle of the empire, to see where the empire originated,
mm-hmm.
And to kind of be there to experience that. And what I'm sort of most wanting to research when I go over there actually is the certain types of landscapes that they have. This English landscape is really, really interesting to me because of the way that the English landscape has tried to be sort of transposed, is that the word, or trying to be placed into a New Zealand context in which the landscapes are very different.
Mm.
But even the way that language is used to describe the landscape, that's been used to describe New Zealand landscape, which is sort of this colonial tool in terms of the history of, well, landscape poetry, the kind of romantics, but then going into tourism and leisure for the middle classes, and so the breaking down of the aristocracy and industry. So the landscape is a really interesting way to look at all of those, how all of those things come together. And I'm interested in how all of those things come together to be told in New Zealand, but I just sort of need to get to the source.
Yeah. So do you have any expectations of what you're going to see, given you've already had this lifetime and ancestral kind of lifetime experience of colonial impact? Do you have any idea what you're going to see?
Well, I'm specifically going to the Lakes District because that's where a lot of the language that we use to describe the landscape was kind of, I don't want to say the word invented, but sort of invented.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the language, that was the way that we think about the land is like beautiful and nourishing and like we think of scenic views. All of that is quite new vernacular. And so it never used to be like that. In fact, like looking at the land was never a thing, and sometimes it was kind of bad in the beginning to actually look at the land because you're too busy to look at the land. Like, you just got to keep going. I mean, I'm kind of hodgepodging these huge ideas. So that's what I want to see is these lakes. And I don't think it's going to be anything extraordinary. I'm not expecting to be like, oh my God, my life has changed. I've had a sublime moment. I'm not expecting that. But, you know, I want to see what is nature over there like. For us, we've got all these invasive species, but over there they're not invasive, so like how does that thrive? Like, I hate to say Wordsworth stuff here, but a daffodil patch, amazing. That's so beautiful. Oh my God, a daffodil patch in England, incredible. So like, I know it sounds kind of cheesy and silly, but I think sometimes sort of have to be there to experience that and to see that properly. But also another kind of facet to the research I want to do over there is looking at Lancelot Brown. Do you know about him?
Oh, no.
So they call him Capability Brown, but he was a landscape designer, and this is like in the 1800s or the late 1700s. He would do all of the garden and landscape design for like huge manor houses, I guess the aristocracy. But he was always doing them and designing them to look natural. So there's this idea that you can build something to look natural and what his idea of natural was. And so he always would build in lakes or like extend huge lakes. In some instances, he would get church spires built on the horizon so that you'd look out from the house and you'd see a church on the horizon. He invented things to help with the way that you viewed the landscape. He found a way to keep cattle in without using fences, which would ruin the way you look. He would put certain trees in places to balance the composition of the landscape when you looked at it. But he all did that based on paintings from Italy of the landscape. So he was designing landscapes based on paintings of landscapes. And so there becomes this like crazy thing going on.
A feedback loop.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm so interested in that landscapes being designed for looking at.
And presumably the extension of that then becomes colonial projection into the New Zealand landscape.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that New Zealand has its unique difference or national identity is based upon, is what makes it different from England. And the thing that makes New Zealand different from England is when they came to settle here is, well, the landscape is very different and there's Māori people living here.
Mm.
And so all of a sudden the landscape and Māori, they're what gives us our national flavour. That's what gives us our uniqueness. And so the landscape will always be held onto and advertised, as you can see, through like 100% Pure New Zealand campaigns, but also this idea of the frontier and the tourist being the kind of new explorer.
Kind of Charles Bloomfield. And
exactly. Yeah. And then you have Māori where it's like, you know, I mean, that's what's even funny about Chris Luxon is that he's the CEO of Air New Zealand, and I think there was a Māori employee and he wasn't allowed to show his tāmoko, but they would have, you know, the kuru on the plane and a Kia Ora magazine. So it's like Māori are only in so much included in the national story and that it serves Pākehā power, basically.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about process a little bit, and we might have covered some of this already, but how do you approach a body of work? I know you've said that they, you know, your paintings end up working as a team, you mm-hmm. know, to tell an overall story, but when do you start getting a sense of what that team is going to deliver, like what narrative they're going to tell? Like, do you usually settle on a single idea and then start, you know, researching that? Do you come across ideas while researching and expand on them?
Well, usually it's kind of like one bigger idea that will sort of get simmered down. So like a good example is coming up with the work for the show at Te Uru, which was all made during the McCann House residency.
Again, we're talking about Still Life show. Yeah,
that's right. And I actually went into that residency with all this other work, of course, that I thought I was going to do. When you apply for that residency, you have a project proposal. And I started trying to do that work. And after maybe a week and a half, I realised it just sort of wasn't happening for various reasons. And the main reason was that I wasn't ready to do that work. I hadn't kind of figured it out in my head yet. But I had been looking a lot at kind of agriculture and what agriculture has done to the land, or like what it means to be doing agriculture in New Zealand, because, well, even before I was looking at agriculture, I was looking at our imports and exports and how that sort of identifies who we are as a country in terms of our trade and our economy. And a lot of it came down to agriculture and the history of agriculture. And so it's just kind of like pulling apart this onion where you sort of have one thing and you just start to pull it apart. And so then the works that sort of talked about land and about people, if you've seen the works, it is about sort of these consumable items that are like New Zealandish. So there's like LMP, obviously milk products, things like this, yogurt, honey.
Antipodes water.
Yes, Antipodes water. And so like how we talk about these things that we produce and consume, these edible, like for human consumption, I mean. And then thinking about books that inform how we know ourselves and what that kind of means and the stories that we tell about ourselves as a nation and how that relates to our economy. So maybe that's a good way to talk about how an idea kind of grows, is that it started by looking at kind of agriculture and then import and exporting and economy and then it turned into these still life paintings.
So you'll just peel back layers until you get to something where you're like, okay, that's how I can distill that idea into a body of work.
Yeah, or like the idea ends up sort of finding its own feet. I mean, adding in the books, that was actually me just playing around setting up still lifes. I really wanted to have a go at doing still life painting. When I first came into painting, I did do a lot of still life, and I wanted to have a go at that again, and then it sort of, everything just kind of fell into place, I guess.
And for a quick listener question, for the still life work, I guess the key elements we're talking about here are three key elements. Botanicals, the branded, you know, commercially branded vessels that act as vases, but then those are sitting on top of usually a book or two from memory.
That's right, yeah. And those books are usually, they're all kind of books that have informed my own thinking and my own practice and my own understanding of New Zealand. Yeah, so I guess that's how an idea comes about. Now that I think about it, it seems quite kind of crazy. And I'm like, is the work actually any good, and does it even talk about those things? But it doesn't really matter because it's kind of found its own way.
Yeah.
And so usually it's like there's sort of one foundational idea and then that kind of grows from it. And sometimes it's about just making the work and seeing what responds. But also the gallery space in itself. So like if I'm approached for an exhibition and I'm making a whole new show, I've always asking for the floor plan because I want to see how big the walls are and I want to see how everything sits across from each other. And
oh, so you're thinking about the gallery space as much as you are what the narrative of the work might be.
Yeah, so the whole exhibition is designed before it goes up.
Oh, wow.
And made, actually. So I guess my most recent show has been at City Gallery, and that was a touring show, so that was a very different experience. But when Folk Nationalism was shown in Tauranga, yeah, it was really highly designed, and it was like, okay, this work goes here, what sits across from that, and how does that activate the ideas? And then it's like, actually, I think a work sitting across from it that looks like this or is about this or copies this would work really well. So the whole thing kind of gets designed. There was definitely changes once all the work got in there, but the key core big work sat there as anchor points, and the other work around it kind of helped the ideas bounce across the room.
So from a process point of view, you're almost starting at two ends and coming together in the middle. One end being what is the theme of the work going to be? For example, the still life work being agriculture. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, how is that work going to read in a physical space at the other end?
Yeah, or how are the works going to talk across that space? How do they talk to each other? And that can even be that you could stand in a gallery and you're looking at a work in front of you, but behind you is a work, and that could be really important that the work sits behind you. Don't ask me to explain that more. But where, you know, instead of all that, there's a work just out of the corner of your eye. And so when you're looking at one work, you're also actually looking at another work at the same time. So it's always about, as well, thinking about what the viewer's going to see and what will be in their sight lines, depending on where their body is in the space. Very quickly.
And that's before you even putting paint on a canvas. You're thinking, what's the theme and how is the work going to sit in a physical space?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. Usually it's like one foundational work that I'll either kind of, depending how big it is, like I'll half paint out, and then during that time that I'm painting, I've got some other ideas. And I just kind of write them down as a list. It's very boring. I don't have like a beautiful workbook full of all these drawings and ideas. It's literally lists. Which makes, yeah, it's not like, so I look through a list of ideas and I'm like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense or that doesn't. And then I'll go, okay, I'll do that. And then I'm working on three at a time. And then another one will come up and hopefully I'll finish one and I'll start another. Yeah.
Well, that touches on something else I wanted to ask about in that scale. Like for a relatively early career artist, you work at these ridiculous scales sometimes. And when I say ridiculous, I don't know, what's the largest work? 4 metres by 3 metres?
I think 5 metres by 3.5.
5 by 3.5. These are enormous paintings. Why work on such a large scale? Like, it seems, sometimes wonder if you're kind of, I don't know, rod for your own back.
Well, I want it to be overpowering. I want it to feel big in the space and I want it to take up space, I think. Having looked at a lot of history painting, they're all very large and they tell grand narratives. And so that's why I use and make work so big, because I want it to be that same size and that same scale. But then having a large painting like that, you kind of want to have delicate little things around it too. I mean, this probably sounds very boring. It's very artistic or like, I don't know. But, you know, the largest painting that I've made was called For Hine. And it was shown at City Gallery for Folk Nationalism. But that was the oldest work shown, actually, from 2017. And that was on the back of recycled billboard material. Mm. So it's this vinyl. But I was really interested in billboards and marketing and cultural capital, or using Māori to sell products, or using bicultural identity to sell an idea of nationalism. So the scale was used to talk about that kind of context as well.
So scale has been really important since day one.
Yes, but makes my life very difficult because I have to find big spaces to paint in. It's a nightmare.
So how are you actually, you know, physically creating those such large works? Like, for example, Gretchen Albrecht talked to me about like building scaffold almost over the floor so she could get to the centre of works. You must be doing something similar, aren't you?
Well, I have a ladder. Well, no, I think...
Well, are you painting on the floor or the works, you know, sitting vertical? Or
against a wall.
Right.
Yes, there was a time when I was finding it difficult to find a new studio in order to paint these bigger works, and I had to paint on unstretched canvas on the ground, which was really annoying and a nightmare. The work turned out fine and good, but it was a really horrible experience, and I was like, I'm never going to let that happen again.
But because physically it's just so uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. And you just don't get any space from the work. But I think with the work For Hine that we just talked about, that was a great moment, because I worked at Studio One Toy Two, which is an art gallery run by the Auckland Council in Auckland and Ponsonby. And I worked there as a facility coordinator. And it was a summer holiday and I had the work to do. And I said, can I just use the upstairs building for the 3 weeks we're on break? And they're like, yeah, sure, that's fine. And so I just painted that on the ground, like just set up drop sheets and stuff, and just painted that one on the ground. And it was the biggest, rushiest 3 weeks of my life. Because it was also Christmas and your family's like, you're going to come home? You're like, no, I've really got to do this work. It's the only time we're going to ever have a space big enough. So it's about trying to find spaces and you just kind of zip in and zip out. It's really like you've got to hustle to get that kind of space. But, you know, one day when I'm feeling more like settled, because I'm kind of going overseas, I haven't really invested in trying to get a really good setup that I'll have for a long time. So I have felt for the past few kind of years I've been sort of in and out of places, and it's not a great way to work because it's sort of exhausting. You just want to be stable and steady so you can spend all your energy thinking. But at the moment, my studio is in my house. I still live alone, and it's two bedrooms, and the second bedroom is my studio, which is, it's fine. Yeah.
You make it work.
I make it work, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, last question, and I ask everyone this. Removing any limit of budget, or whether a work is, you know, held in a public institution, what work or artist work would you love to live with?
My favourite work in the whole world does not, it's like I couldn't live with it because it only really makes sense where it is. So it's this mural that's painted at Otago in the Whanganui, and it's in the Whanganui there's a stage. And so it's the background of the stage. And it's this amazing painting of the landscape that's outside. So it's really hard to explain, but when you walk into the Whanganui, you see the painting of the landscape, which includes Aramoana Spit and the Tairoa heads, and which is Pukekura. And then when you look at it, you see that, but behind you is that exact picture, but like in the opposite way. So when you turn around and if you looked out the door, you'd see exactly that, but for real on the landscape. And so it kind of puts your whole body in this sort of spin. It's like it kind of changes reality in a way. Does it? I find it so hard to explain.
Well, it sounds like it's inspiration for the consideration that you give to gallery spaces that we were talking about before in process.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. Yeah.
Well, which came first? The experience of that work or carefully considering how you're going to put together a show?
Carefully considering how to put together a show. I guess we got, that was an art school education stuff. But
that work at Otago has reinforced that.
It has, but also the kind of importance of the landscape is that a Whanganui is the embodiment of an ancestor. So you walk into a Whanganui, you walk into the ancestor, right? Mm. And the ancestor in this Whanganui is Tamatea, who was the captain of the Takitimu waka. And so inside the ancestor is the landscape. So even that is really interesting in this kind of idea of ecology. You know, mountains are our ancestors, rivers are our ancestors. And so even inside the ancestor is still this landscape. I'm not explaining it very well, but that's what I like about the work, is it's very difficult to explain. And the other great thing about that work is that I found out that it was painted by Jacqueline Fraser's son, and Jacqueline Fraser's like this amazing Ngāi Tahu artist, and her son painted it because coming in the next week was a television show for Māori television where they were going around filming different marae, and they were like, we need to quickly do a big cleanup, and so they decided just to paint this mural. That's a story that I've been told, so if I'm wrong, I'm more than happy to know that I'm wrong. And I thought that was absolutely amazing to kind of come full circle and to see actually the history of different Ngāi Tahu artists that whakapapa to Otago. To understand also like where my own practice comes from in its own kind of whakapapa as well.
As always, thanks for listening. Your best chance to see Aisha's work at the moment is in Ototahi. Her work, The Rupture, that we discussed in this episode, is on show at the Christchurch Art Gallery until the 21st of July. Or contact Jana Miller's gallery for available work. Please join me for episode 23 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.